Okay, welcome back to Coast in our final hour here with our special guest, Jack Barnhart, and we'll take your calls as well as we talk about the Maya calendar, the Maya culture, archaeoastronomy. I want to get into these duendes, these little creatures that fascinates me, and so much more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Ed Barnhart with us. Ed, I can't let you get away without talking more about these duendes. These creatures. I mean, how did the myth start?
Well, I think it's always been there. In fact, they talk about them as small people, and you see small people actually in Maya art.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
Dwarves were typically magical beings that are talked about and seen sometimes even in courtly art. You see a little dwarf raising his hand up to a king. But the Maya are all about them. Every Maya person down there, no matter whether they live in the mountains, the jungles, or the coast, they talk about duendes, these spirits, and they talk about them in different ways. Sometimes they're little tiny people like dwarves or sprites. Sometimes some of the people in the Yucatan talk about them as these odd creatures that are shadows, that you only see them as shadows, and that their voices sound like the fuzz on a bad station on your TV. They're fascinating creatures. Everybody talks about them.
Do they hurt people?
Sometimes they do. But the Maya talk about them as people who can see into your soul. And they know who's good and who's bad. And they tend to only attack people who have malice in their hearts.
Malice in their hearts. That's an interesting take. They were able to find that person, search them out, huh?
They can apparently see into your soul. They can see what you're thinking. So if someone's walking in their part of the forest with bad intent, they will mess with that person. Now, a person who's in need and nice, they might well help that person. They can be helpful and nice spirits. They're tricksters, but they see into the hearts of men, and they will hurt those that they feel are a danger to the environment they inhabit.
What do you think in your studies, Ed, has been the most fascinating aspect of investigating this culture? Anything mind-boggling there?
Well, I really, things like what we're just talking about, meeting Maya people and talking about their interaction with their environment today has actually turned out to be one of my favorite aspects. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm an archaeologist. I went there, intending to study the dead, but sometimes my favorite things are just like what we just talked about, things that modern Maya people tell me and how they connect to the environment they're in. But, in that same vein, I think that some of the most wonderful things I have been part of is when modern Maya people who are, just poor, humble folks, maybe that I hire from a local village,
mm-hmm.
how absolutely connected they are to these magnificent, temple-filled ruins. And their discovery process, working with me when we uncover things of their own identity and heritage, is a great thing to me.
And tell me about the worshiping of a Fang deity. What's that all about?
That's down in South America. That's separate from the Maya in Central America and Mexico. The Fang deity is down in South America. And despite what a lot of textbooks say, that there's a big pantheon of gods down there, I think that there's one that we see from the very beginnings of South American ancient art all the way up through the Inca that's called the Fang deity, or early literature calls him the principal deity, as we see him in the earliest of cities, Chavín de Huntar. But He's a monotheistic deity that they're worshiping. They give him different names. The Moche call him Ayapec. The Inca call him Viracocha. The people down on the coast call him Pachacamac. But you, if you really look at the art, you see the same face again and again and again over a period of some 3,000 years.
Do the chupacabras come up at all in any of these cultures?
Well, you know, down in Palenque, they talk about them all the time. When I lived in Palenque for 3 years, people talked about chupacabra all the time and how it was on their cows and goats there all the time. And
they've got to be real.
There, it turned out to be, you know, that there were lots of vampire bats down there, and they would grab onto their cows and put, you know, vampire-like holes into their necks.
Jeez.
And they decided that these were the chupacabras. So, yeah, they do talk about them as far as Chiapas, Mexico.
How does a cow get a vampire bat off its neck?
It doesn't.
It doesn't. That's right. Horrible. Okay, let's go to some of the calls.
You know, George, I took a moment to look up your Maya birthday in the Maya calendar.
Oh, really? My June 4th. Tell me about that.
You, June 4th, 1950, not to reveal that, that's on Wikipedia, too. You are actually a jaguar in the Maya calendar.
Oh, well, now, what does that mean?
12 jaguar, 12 ish. And it comes along with all sorts of different things about your personality and destiny. It says that you're a practical, patient, and intelligent person.
Thank you.
And that you're astute and decisive, generous, and you live up to your responsibilities, that you're physically strong and energetic, you're good with animals, and you're a powerful warrior when you need to be, and that you're a hunter by nature, and you have a large sexual appetite, and you're definitely wealthy. That sound like you or not you?
Well, 9 out of 10's not bad.
It also says your professions would be warrior, animal trainer, hunter, strategist, philosopher, mathematician, and doctor.
Any weaknesses? These sound all pretty positive.
Actually, there are. I separate them out as negative traits. It says they can be overbearing, vain, and arrogant, and they need to be the center of attention. They're prone to illness, and sometimes they can be angry.
That's not true. Call me Sir, too, by the way, on this show. Okay, let's go.
Those are what modern Maya people using their calendar would say is your personality and destiny.
Were they numerologists?
The Maya were very much numerologists, absolutely. They most of the numbers they used were extracted from celestial observations, but they would put them together and assign a lot of qualities to them. In fact, their calendar, some cycles of it were based on numerology.
All right, let's go to the calls. Dan is in Lockport, Illinois, to get us started this hour. Hey, Dan, go ahead.
How are you, George?
Good, Dan. Thank you.
Good. I could scratch off my bucket list. But I'd like to ask you, yes, leading up to the 12/21/12 prophecy, I was reading a lot of websites, and one thing that really stuck out was the fact that it was prophesied that a web would cover the earth at the end time of how we were living then. So, and that was attributed to possibly the www dot, and you know all the problems that come with that. Just to name one, ISIS could recruit around the world right off the internet. They don't have to go anywhere for that. And you see how the world is in chaos. And along with that prophecy, it said that at the end of a 7-year period, beginning at 12/21/12, the world is going to be either living in total harmony or it's going to begin living in total chaos. And I was just wondering if you're familiar with that and if you could expand on that if you are.
Interesting take. Go ahead,
well,
Ed.
George, do you have a comment before I chime in?
Well, you know, I was caught up, as I said earlier, in the frenzy of the 12/21 prophecy as well. I thought we were going to have some kind of solar event from the sun. I think I'm still right, Ed, but I think it's going to come later. And so I guess my question to you, too, would be, how do we know that that end time calendar was accurate? What if it's 2 or 3 years from now?
An excellent thought. We really do base what we think the Maya calendar is correlated to based on imperfect evidence. We could well be as much as 260 years off.
Uh-huh.
In our correlation between the Maya calendar and the now called Gregorian calendar. So the thought that we're just misinterpreting or mislinking the Maya calendar dates to Christian dates is entirely possible.
Have you talked to modern-day Mayans, and do they know anything about their culture?
You know, they do, and they have a very strong tradition of their calendar, but not the long count calendar, which is the one that brings us to that 2012 date. They didn't know anything about it. They gave up that calendar, really, before the Spanish even showed up. So Maya, who are, you know, people like you and me, they're smart. They read books. They have internet accounts. And they started learning about the Maya calendar when everybody started asking them. And they came up with their own opinions about it, and their opinions based on their culture and their teachings from their grandfathers is that it was going to be the turn of a 400-year period called a Bakhtun, and it was going to be a period of renewal and the end of old ways and the beginning of new ways. It's an opportunity to change ourselves. Not necessarily a change that would be imposed upon us, but a time that the Maya had from way back when decided was a good time to change. They're a cyclical people, so they believe that life should change occasionally and renew itself. And the modern Maya opinion of 2012 was that it was the proper time to change and evolve.
All right, let's go out to the state of Washington now. Marilyn's with us on the wildcard line. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, and I was on when you used to, before you were on Coast, you had me on speaking on archaeoastronomy one time. And I'm the first person in the world who challenged an institution, an accredited institution of higher learning, and won this degree in 1980, and then, you know, it was in archaeoastronomy. And I'm the first person to propose that the ancient Mayans had primitive reflector telescopes, and they also had refractor telescopes. And I gave a talk in Calgary in 1978 before a group of 1,000 British and Canadian and American archaeoastronomers and astronomers and archaeologists. So I have I specialized in the Mayan calendar, but one of the things that I wanted to point out was Tony Avaney actually wasn't the person who coined the term archaeoastronomy. It was Elizabeth Chesley Beatty in 1973, and she wrote a paper on this, and it was in June of 73. And before that, there was Heinrich Nissan in the mid-19th century. And then, of course, Norman Lockyer was the one that Gerald Hawkins really studied from, and also Alexander Thom. He was a good friend of Alexander Thom, who was in Britain, and he pioneered a lot of archaeoastronomy in the 30s through the 70s. And then, of course, his son and grandson continued on. But I worked for Gerald Hawkins. He hired me in 1967 as an astronomer to help out in the observatory. And I'm the one who actually made Carl Sagan famous.
Oh, did you? How? How'd you do that?
Well, he wanted me to, we had just hired Sagan, and he came from Harvard, and he had written a book, An Intelligent Life in the Universe, and he co-authored that with the Russian astronomer Shilkovsky. So what happened was Hawkins wanted me to coordinate a series of lectures on intelligent life in the universe or extraterrestrial life, and so I got the bright idea to do it as a panel discussion, and I got a priest from Boston College and a rabbi from Boston University and a minister from Harvard Divinity. And then I had Ashley Montague come on as the humanist viewpoint or agnostic viewpoint. And then I added Richard Berenson, who was an astronomer at Boston University, and also, as Isaac Asimov, because
you got all the heavy hitters there, Marilyn.
Yeah, because I know I used to eat lunch every day.
Okay,
with Asimov.
How about, do you have a quick question for Ed before we hit the break here?
No, I just wanted to tell you that Johnny Carson asked if he saw the show aired, because they got WGBH to air the show.
Yeah,
and that's, he started having him on, and then he put up the money for the Cosmos series, so that's how it happened.
He did
but I just wanted to point out that by the time in 1963, when Hawkins coined the term astroarchaeology, by the time he hired me in 1967, he called it archaeoastronomy.
All right, great. A little history there for us, Ed.
You know your stuff. Thanks for clarifying.
She sure does. She sure does. It's, everybody listens to this program. They really do. Hey, Ed, where can people track your work, your websites? Where are you these days?
Well, I'm in Austin, Texas, but I spend most of my time down south. If people want to learn more about the Maya calendar, they can check out my website at mayan-calendar.com. That's where we have an app that'll tell people their birthdays and let them calculate Maya dates. We also have a wall calendar that we do every year that correlates the two calendars together with some beautiful photos, and that's also at mayan-calendar.com. So people can look at that. If you want to travel with me and my group, you'd go to mayaexploration.org, which is our nonprofit where we do our research and share it with folks through educational tours. So those are two good ways to get a hold of
it. Do you know our buddy Alex Jones down there in Austin?
I met him years ago in a bar, but otherwise I have not really had much dealings
good
with
guy. What about going under the bridge?
He's
where
much
all
more fame than I at this point.
All those bats under the bridge, have you seen that?
Oh, absolutely. We love our bats.
That's
here.
Amazing.
We have a population of over a million when at the peak of the summer.
Underneath that bridge?
Underneath the Congress Bridge. Yes,
wow.
We treasure them.
But when they fly off, they darken the sky.
Population of bats in the world.
It really is. Okay, well, we're going to come back in a moment with you, Ed, and take final phone calls. So those of you on hold, just hang. And again, his websites are all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. He heads up the Maya Exploration Center. Fascinating information about a culture that really is not with us anymore. And it either died off or simply faded away. But we're not going to fade away. We're coming back for more. On our next Coast to Coast program, mentalist and memory expert Jim Carroll joins us, talking about mental performance and memory and so many other things on Coast to Coast. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Ed Barnhart with us, of course, and your final questions we will take as well. Ed, were there any depictions anywhere in the Mayan culture of extraterrestrials, weird-looking creatures, anything like that?
You know, art history is a wonderful field in which there are many opinions. and people say that there are things that could be interpreted as such. The primary one is the Tomb of Pakal, of course, where I believe it was Eric Von Doniggen that first suggested that he was not falling down the world tree, but rather driving a spaceship. That's one that's interpreted as such. I have a different interpretation. But, you know, I think this is somewhat joking, but a question to ask. There's a primary god called Kawil. And Kawil, when he's in color, he's green. And oftentimes, he has a weird face. It's a weird and almost alien face. It's reptilian in ways. And when you see him in Maya art, he's almost always very small. there are little effigies of him that kings are holding up, where he appears to be about, you know, no more than a foot and a half tall, but I have never seen him as the same size as a man. So he is a small green creature that's said to be the god of kingly magic, and he's always small and green and has a weird reptilian face. If I never hear anybody discuss it like that, but if I was to put a label as an alien on anything in the Maya art, I'd say Kawil. I joke that we're misinterpreting his name, that he's actually Gazoo, not Kawil, but Kazoo, the little guy that tells Fred Flintstone and Barney what to do.
Those amazing times. Would you have liked to have lived then?
Oh, I think not. It would have been a terrible time. Boy, the Maya had a hard life. I've thought that, you know, if I could go back in time and see the Maya, no, they'd probably sacrifice me immediately.
Your history,
right? If they were a ref folk, they'd probably see me as an alien intruder and kill me within
off you go.
Of me arriving.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Kathleen in Los Angeles. Hey, Kathleen, good morning to you.
Hello, George and Ed. I have a different type of question for you concerning the Maya and the Aztecs. Not the Aztecs, the Incas. Don't we have an incredible legacy of foodstuffs from these cultures? That weren't they the developers of the potato, the avocado, the tomato, chilies, corn, special squashes, high-protein beans, quinoa, chocolate, pima cotton?
Absolutely
all
right.
Of these things, and
the diet of Europe was absolutely
cultures, more. It took centuries to develop these things, and we forget about it. We're living on our culture in the West advanced because of the potato, and the textiles. Did they use cotton textiles or the llama hair, or what did they use for that too?
Textiles, the Maya fairly well exclusively cotton, though some groups use tree bark as well. Down in South America, they did use wool from the llama as well, but they had a wonderful textile tradition that was textiles. Cotton was developed very, very early. In South America, interestingly, the very first domesticated crop was not food. It was cotton. Textiles were more important than growing food to them back there, but they did have a wonderful diet, and most of the foods that Europe was eating were terrible before they met the New World. They got so many gifts, as you explained very thoroughly, corn and potatoes being the primary ones, but so many spices as well. You know, chocolate and vanilla were both from Mesoamerica. Those are things that we treasure today, and Europe just did not have those flavors before they met the Maya.
What kind of language did they speak, Ed?
They still speak it today. They speak today there are 33 different Maya languages.
Wow.
And we can see them reflected in the hieroglyphic script. So, you know, that was one of the big breakthroughs that Russian epigrapher Yuri Kornazov made, that Americans just at the time, back in the 1950s, couldn't believe. He, without ever having gone to Mexico and ever having met a Maya person, made a ignorant assumption that the Maya must still be speaking the same language that the hieroglyphs are in, and he was right.
At their time, at their moment, were they one of the most advanced cultures on the planet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Europe was literally living in the Dark Ages when the Maya were at their height. You know, London was a mud hole, while Tikal was a thriving, beautiful metropolis of 100,000 people.
Next up, we have Jay in Alabama on the wild card line. Jay, you're up.
Greetings and salutations. George, you're a refreshing voice when I'm on the road. I'm not a truck driver, but I am in a shuttle business. And you're very refreshing, and God must shine his face on me because People take years to get through to coast to coast, and I just get through all the time.
You know the secret. Don't give it out.
I don't know if it's a secret. Well, I'm not going to give it out. But as far as the calendar goes, we have many different calendars. And what's interesting is in history, we do not hear about the Hebrew calendar. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, which is in September, the new year actually in the Hebrew calendar comes around. And this year is 5757. I get to celebrate two new years, the correct new year, and we're on the Julian calendar, correct?
That's right.
Gregorian, but yes, the Christian.
Right. Okay. And the thing about it is that when you study history, no one studies history anymore, we find truth, and the truth will set you free. And it's interesting that we have people out there who are on their own, investigating this on the internet, and they're finding the truth, but the truth has got to be silenced for the people who are in power who want to come down on us. But anyway, remember, Irondale, Alabama is the railroad capital of the country. And George, before I beam out of here, I have a very interesting picture which was taken on the crossroads of the railroad, because we're railroad capital of the country. And from Alabama, Roll Tide. Beam me up, Scotty!
I like those comments. Ed, you want to react to that or go to the next call?
I think we could just move on to the next call. I do respect the Jewish calendar. It's a very old one, and I agree with him that that it's not mentioned enough. It was an old calendar, much, much older than the Christian one.
Who was the most violent of the cultures, the Aztecs?
Yeah, I'd say the Aztecs were certainly the most violent. They sacrificed people on a literal daily basis.
What would make a civilization do that?
You know, funny enough, it's reverence. It's reverence. They came to a conclusion that what their gods needed was sacrifice, and sacrifice is the greatest sacrifice is life. And the Aztecs never sacrificed, you know, the village idiot or the person that was pissing them off. They gave the best of the best. They gave their children. They gave their virgins. And even when it came to warriors on the other side of the battlefield, they captured the bravest, the strongest, the best, and those are the ones they sacrificed. They, to the Aztec, they were giving up something as a testimony to how much they revered their gods.
Back to the calls. Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joey, go ahead.
How are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask your guest, Ed, about the Yucatan area. The statement that an asteroid impacted that area, was there any kind of evidence that you found that affected subsequent civilizations?
No, the Chinchulub crater there that is definitely a meteor impact happened so, so far back in time that humans weren't even really humans at that time. So as far as civilizations, it was earlier than any civilization. They say it might well have been part of why the dinosaurs went extinct.
When the Mayan culture was around, and what's that time period primarily?
You know, as early, really, if you go to Yucatan, like our last caller just talked about, I've been in a cave in Yucatan where we have evidence of charcoal handprints up to 10,000 years ago in Yucatan.
Jeez.
But as far as the Maya civilization, we could bring it up to maybe 1500 BC,
okay,
the beginning of it.
Were they around 1000 AD? 1100 AD?
They were driving around 1000 AD.
At what point, at what moment of time did they seem to dissipate?
Well, there was a big change in where they lived and what they did about 800 or 900 AD. That's the mysterious disappearance of the Maya,
right,
where they,
do you think they are just
left a bunch of cities and moved a new one?
Did they go as a group, do you think?
I think that they spread out all over the place. I think there were hundreds of independent city-states that all decided that this pattern of following kings had to end. And it happened right about the end of one of these 400-year periods, just like 2012 was the 13th. At the end of the ninth 400-year period, everybody said, you know, forget following these despotic kings. Let's go and reorganize ourselves as councils. And they spread out. A lot of them went back to the early places they used to live, like the highlands of Guatemala and the lowlands of the Yucatan Peninsula.
Those
big cities.
Might they have been Atlanteans?
You know, I don't really think so. I think that Atlantis is an idea that was sprouted in the minds of Greeks a long time ago and as enamored people, but I don't think the Maya have anything to do with them. I think that the people of Central America deserve their own credit as creating a culture that is still not reached its place in history the way it should.
West Palm Beach, Florida. Let's get Mike in. Go ahead, Mike.
How you doing?
Good.
In the 1980s, there was a story in the New York Times about a Roman ship, the remains of a Roman ship found at harbor, on the bottom of the harbor of Rio de Janeiro. An American archaeologist found it, said, this is a Roman ship, I have the runes. The Brazilian government got very upset about it. They said he insulted the Portuguese explorers around Brazil. They threw him out of the country, and they bombed the ruins, actually exploded them.
Wow.
I remember that. Now, years later, I went to Cancun, and I took a side trip to Chichen Itza, you know, a bus trip with a Mayan guide. And I asked the Mayan guide the following. Is there any evidence of Roman civilization or contact with Roman civilization in Chichen Itza in that area? And he said the roads that the Mayans made were copies of the Roman roads. He actually said that. So I got to Chichen Itza, and I was looking around the ruins, and I found a big bathtub, huge bathtub. And there were two holes on the side of the bathtub, like for hot water, cold water. And then I remembered the Romans were big in baths, you know?
Oh, they loved them. Yeah.
I'm not an archaeologist. This is what I observed. And apparently, the Romans had ships weighing thousands of tons. Remember the movie Cleopatra, for example? Everybody saw that.
Yeah.
And you see those Roman ships. They weighed 1,000 tons easily, those war ships. Columbus's ships weighed about 100 tons. They could have crossed over very easily for the Atlantic. There was no problem with the technology. And I think they did. And there's also, remember the program, the cocaine mummies? And appeared on the History Channel.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and where did cocaine come from? South America.
Well, there's talk that the Chinese made it, that the Italians, the Romans, of course, made it. It's amazing culture. And, Ed, we're out of time, my friend. You stay in touch with us. If you, on any of your archaeological discoveries, find anything, let us know first, if you would, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Ed Barnhart's website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Great calls, by the way. Thanks for participating, everybody. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.